This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. You know, in August, Florida lawmakers usually are busy raising money or campaigning, not cartography. But this week, state legislators did just that. They made a map. They had to make a map. You see, a state judge forced them after declaring the previous map laying out congressional districts throughout the Sunshine State unconstitutional. Two districts specifically bobbed and weaved so much across the central and northeastern portion of Florida that the judge said the process drawing up the districts, quote, made a mockery, end quote, of a process that is supposed to be devoid of politics under Florida's Constitution. So this week, lawmakers went to Tallahassee and voted mostly along party lines to redraw 7 of the 27 districts in the state. None of the new lines are in South Florida, but if this map is approved, it could influence the Florida delegation in Washington, D.C. While questions remain, though, about the problematic and political process that led to the bad map. We begin here on the Florida Roundup with redistricting in Florida. Gary Fineout has covered the issue for us in Tallahassee for the Associated Press. Patty Mazzei covers county and local politics for the Miami Herald. Both of them joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Gary, let's begin with you. About 368,000 Florida voters are affected by the new map, according to a George Mason University consultant. How many districts are involved in moving boundaries?
Well, there's 7 districts out of the current 27 that were affected by the changes. And basically, as you pointed out, those are all in north and central Florida. And that probably is part of the argument about why some people don't like this new version, because it made some changes, but it didn't make a lot of substantial changes. And for instance, there was the League of Women Voters wanted to move one of the districts from stretching from Jacksonville to Orlando to instead go across North Florida. The legislature didn't do that. Instead, they kind of nipped and tucked in a lot of different places.
And we'll talk with the president of the Florida League of Women Voters in just a moment, Gary. But is this enough to tip the balance if the judge approves this map in 2014? And perhaps more importantly, what does it do to the likelihood of a political balance in 2016, a presidential election year in this purple state of Florida?
I think if this map stands, there is the possibility that you'd maybe have one, maybe 2 seats flip. But even that is stretching it. I mean, the partisan balance in some of these seats shifted ever so slightly. I mean, you had Dan Webster's seat. It became slightly more Democratic.
And that's the seat near Orlando.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes. That's the seat in Orlando. He had a pretty tough challenge in 2012 against Val Demings. So if he has a tough opponent again during a presidential election year, then maybe. But I think the issue is that if you look at the numbers really closely, you'll see that it wasn't anything significant where you would just instantly say, oh, yeah, that seat is going to flip now.
Florida ranked among the worst states for gerrymandered political districts. This is according to some research by the University of Chicago Law School. And Nicholas Stephanopoulos told WLRN this week, this is despite the state's constitutional amendment banning politics from the map process.
So Florida is almost unique in having a requirement that there not be any partisan motivation behind a district plan. What Florida does not have is an actual independent commission. Other states take the power to draw the district lines away from the politicians in the first place.
The politicians had to come back to this process because the state judge concluded the first process was flawed, but they didn't address the process. They just came up with a different product here, Gary.
Well, correct. Now, and that happens to be part of what is going to be the ongoing legal battle, because what happened is that the judge in the case said, I still think you should draw the new map, legislature. I'm not prepared at this point in time to bring in the experts, to bring in the people, to try to figure this out myself. So I would prefer you to go back and do it. Now, as we said, he, of course, the judge could say, I don't like what you did. I don't think you went far enough. And that maybe he now does have to think about whether or not he's going to have to bring in his own experts and figure out if he needs to draw up his own map.
Patty Mazzei of the Miami Herald covering local politics here in South Florida. We know that the South Florida congressional districts were not affected by either of these maps here, but could it shake up some politics as we move to 2016? Patty, are you with us?
The fact that, for example, you had David Rivera in Congressional District 26 say that he was going to suspend his campaign pending this decision. And then he came back and kind of campaigned quietly in the midst of the lawsuit, I thought was at least interesting.
He certainly was. And we know that when it comes to state politics, regions of the state's delegations tend to tie together. But with the 27 districts in Florida, with seven of them redrawn, does it set up, Patty, at all any kind of, I guess, balance of power between South Florida and Central and Northeast Florida at all?
I think where we see that more strikingly is in the state legislature rather than in the congressional delegation. And Gary can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's usually where I've seen in the past the North-South divide.
And here's why I asked that, Gary, is because it is the state legislators that Patty mentions that are responsible for drawing the boundaries that affect the 27 U.S. congressional districts that are a result of this process.
Well, yeah, and there is no doubt that the state legislature has always been an interesting place when it comes down to geopolitics. We have a lot of geopolitics in the state legislature. There was once a Polk County legislator who once told me for a story I did when I worked for the Miami Herald, those people down in South Florida are always complaining with their mouth full. So there is no doubt that in the legislature there continues to always be a dynamic there. I think with the congressional delegation, I think on a lot of things they – at least in the past, there would be times that they would be unified. And clearly, on certain issues that, whether it's like immigration or something like that, you'll see some South Florida Republicans who have a sort of different viewpoint on stuff like that than, say, Republicans, members of their own party from other parts of the state.
So the complaint of the other parts of the state, or, you know, South Florida complains a lot, is the loudest about complaining about the process, but yet receives probably the most money back in terms of state services.
Well, I haven't done that analysis in many years. I think when I was with the Herald, we did an analysis that concluded that South Florida probably contributed more tax dollars than they got back. But I will admit that that data is very old.
Some years old. Leading the complaint against the state or the U.S. Congressional district map was the Florida League of Women Voters. And Deidre McNabb is the president of that organization. She joins us here. Deidre, do you support what the legislators redrew this week in Tallahassee?
Well, good morning, Tom. And no, we don't. We were very concerned with how suspiciously alike the new map that they came out with appeared to be compared to the old map. And frankly, we were very disappointed and concerned with what appeared to be a very closed-door process. So I think the vote at the end of the day showed that there was a partisan schism. But most importantly, this was an opportunity for the legislature to really make good on their promise that it would be an open and transparent process. And we had really sorely hoped that they would go back to the drawing board with a real desire to come forward with some maps that the people of Florida can feel confident are valid and constitutional.
Deidre McNabb, with the Florida League of Women Voters, let me ask you, if the judge ultimately approves this map, he's expected to hold a hearing on this August 20th, and August 21st, the new map would take effect if approved. Would you support that final court decision?
I'm going to really hold off on making any pronouncement on that. Our attorneys are working hard on preparing for the hearings next week. I would say this. I do believe strongly that we are light years ahead of where the state used to be. Gerrymandering has been one of the biggest problems in Florida. It basically means that voters don't have real choices when they go to the polls.
We may be ahead of where we were, but are we where we need to be?
Definitely not. And that's why we're still in the court. And we will stay in the court until we feel that we are where the state needs and deserves to be.
Does this map process still belong in Tallahassee in the state capitol?
Well, that is a great question. And I heard Gary's very good answer. A number of other states clearly have gone the route of the Independent Redistricting Commission. The league has been involved in four different citizen petition drives. And we did have an earlier version that included both the Independent Redistricting Commission and the rules. We are, in the state of Florida, required to have citizen amendments with only a single subject. So I would say this is an issue, the idea of the Independent Redistricting Commission. that we will certainly be looking at very carefully for the future.
Deidre McNabb, the president of the Florida League of Women Voters, leading the challenge of the state legislators' redrawing of the U.S. congressional map in Florida. Gary Finout with the Associated Press, Patty Mazzei with Miami Herald. Gary, finally here, if the judge approves it and this map does go forward, this is the map for the primary election and the map for the general election. Is that right?
No. That's a separate decision. I mean, he could approve the map, but then he left himself wiggle room. It was a very odd ruling. He basically said, I think there should be a special election maybe held to deal with this map, but I haven't made up my mind on that. So what furthermore, I hate to complicate the matters even more. Furthermore, he left open the possibility that we would only have elections in the affected districts. So
in the seven districts, at least on
in the seven
the new
districts.
Map
and
proposed,
so
yeah.
I think one of the scenarios that has been thrown out is you could have the possibility that the November election would be the primary for those seven districts, and then you'd have a special election in December that would be the general election.
All right. So while we don't know yet if the congressional districts in Central and Northeast Florida will change or not, early voting we do know is underway in South Florida. From hanging chads and absentee ballot fraud, long lines stretching Election Day well into the midnight hours, South Florida has clearly a troubled voting record. Have you voted in the primary? What was your experience like? Let us know on Twitter, at WLRN is the handle. Patty, what's changed during this early voting cycle ahead of the August 26th primary here in South Florida?
Well, legislators have allowed supervisors of election to go back, if they so wish, to the 2 weeks of early voting. So in Miami-Dade County, for example, they decided to take advantage of all those days, and they started early voting on Monday. Broward started today. Mm-hmm. They're both going to go through next Sunday, August 24th, which is also a change from the presidential election. The legislature had originally said no more Sunday voting, and that had caused some problems, especially among Democrats, who African-American churches tend to bring people out to the polls that day.
Yeah.
So we're going to see that again. And the legislature also allowed counties to have different sites for early voting. So you're going to see places that counties consider larger and more comfortable. In Miami-Dade, for example, there are 20 early voting sites. Four of them are new, so that there should be a little bit more parking and a little bit more space.
And I believe Monroe County and Palm Beach County also open for early voting. What about new technology that's involved getting away from the butterfly ballots?
Well, Miami-Dade in particular had a problem in 2010 with bottlenecking at precincts when voters were registering. So they invested some money in allowing everyone to check in electronically. That's the way it has always been in early voting, mm-hmm. at least in recent years. And that's the way it is in Broward, for example. But now everyone on Election Day in Miami-Dade County will be able to use these machines. It should speed things up. They also invested in a new ballot sorting machine at headquarters to count absentee ballots. In 2012, if you remember, there was a mechanical mishap that slowed everything down.
Yeah, Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald. And David Ovalle also joins us from the Miami Herald. David, Miami Lakes Mayor Michael Pizzi found this week not guilty of taking bribes. This was an FBI sting operation that the jurors disagreed with the prosecution. What did we learn out of that jury box in terms of the prosecution's case and where it failed?
Well, I think really the jurors did a thorough job of examining the evidence, and they came to the conclusion that there was simply not enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, the government's case was never overwhelming. There were no clear-cut, you know, admissions from Mr. Pizzi on any of the undercover recordings that, you know, I will do this for you if you give me this. You know, it was all sort of double-speak and coded talk, and you know, he seemed pretty reluctant to take money or at least to be sort of engaged with this with the agents that were undercover. So I think ultimately, and one juror told us that, you know, it was a lot of suspicious activity, and Pizzi definitely came across as like an arrogant guy with a lot of cagey behavior, but in the end, there just simply wasn't enough evidence.
Plenty of arrogance in politics everywhere, but not corruption in this case, according to the jury. What's his political future then? He was suspended by the governor a year ago when these charges came down. He talked last night about going back to City Hall to celebrate last night. What do we know about his future at City Hall Miami Lakes?
Well, that's the interesting twist, and that's something that's shaking out as we speak. The governor has just told reporters that he does not plan to reinstate Mr. Pizzi to the position of mayor of Miami Lakes. Of course, you know Miami Lakes had a special election, and they elected a successor. But now, like in previous cases, normally the governor reinstates the politician. He did that when Michelle Spence Jones beat her criminal charges. She was a Miami City Commissioner, and she got back pay and went back to her position. I'm not sure. I imagine this will end up in court. But as of right now, Scott is not reinstating him, and Mr. Pizzi is saying, hey, I am the mayor of Miami Lakes. So it's a little bit of a standoff.
A little bit of a standoff there. Lots of politics here in the first segment of the Florida Roundup. David Ovalle covering the Miami Lakes. Mayor Michael Pizzi found not guilty this week of taking bribes for the Miami Herald. Patty Mazzei, early voting in South Florida. Patty also with the Miami Herald, and Gary Fineout with the Associated Press. Thanks to all three here as we get things underway with politics. Still to come on the program, it's been more than a month and a half now since two people were killed, seven shot while they were in a Liberty City front yard. The aftermath of a mass shooting next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN.
To me, this is about domestic terrorism. Anytime you take an AK-47 and an AR-15 and you shoot 10 people, you're really and truly terrorizing the community.
Miami City Commissioner Keon Hardiman there talking about what happened in his neighborhood of Liberty City back on June 24th. It was just after 2 o'clock in the morning when two men in an SUV pulled up to a small apartment building on Northwest 12th Avenue. A group of people were out hanging out on the front steps talking. Two men got out of that SUV armed with high-powered rifles and let loose a spray of bullets in what police think was a gang turf war. By the time that shooting was over, 9 people had been hit, innocent bystanders to the battle. 7 injured, 2 died. It was one of the worst mass shootings that South Florida has seen in decades. WLRN's Nadesh Green has been looking beyond the bullets in Liberty City in a series that we've had on the air and online this week called Aftermath. She joins me now here on the Florida Roundup. Nadesh, let's talk about the shooting on June 24th first. Have there been any arrests?
According to police, there have not been any arrests related to this shooting. However, in the course of my reporting, Hermana Richardson, who is the mother of one of the victims, says police did tell her that they have the suspects in custody on unrelated charges, but they have not yet been charged with the mass shooting. But the official word from police is that there are no arrests tied to this shooting and that they're working actively on the case.
What do we know about possible charges against those that that are suspected in some other crime, but as the investigation to the June 24th mass shooting continues?
We really don't know anything because police is mum on the subject right
yeah.
now.
So what do we know about that ongoing investigation? Is it active? It's open? Do we know about staffing, personnel associated to it, that kind of thing?
We know the homicide team is working on it. It is an active investigation, so the police is not saying much, of course, about their investigation or the tactics in which they're doing the investigations. But in the course of my reporting out in the Liberty City neighborhood and speaking to people who lived in the same building where that mass shooting happened, speaking to the family members of some of the victims who were shot and murdered, I know that they are, you know, trying to get witnesses to come forward, people who were there on the scene to say what they know. And what I'm hearing is that it's been difficult. Some of the witnesses who were shot do not want to cooperate with police.
It's been one of the issues that you've uncovered in your reporting in this series, The Aftermath. Dana Carr is the police commander in Liberty City.
I get frustrated because so many people were there and we did not have anyone saying anything.
Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado told you as much the same thing when you spoke with him.
If we only had the component of the residents saying what they know, I think that we can solve this problem.
This is the no snitch culture that you cover in The Aftermath. And I'd like the audience to participate here if they've encountered this no snitch in their neighborhood, Liberty City or not, to call into our program here at 800-743-9576 1-800-743-WLRN on Twitter at WLRN or online at WLRN.org. What are the forces that are behind this no snitch attitude?
I mean, there are multiple reasons why people in the Liberty City neighborhood do not want to speak with police. Of course, you have the gang members and, you know, the individuals who might be tied to the person who is, you know, committing the crime, and they don't want to rat out their friend, their brother, their cousin or whomever. But then you also have another component where individuals are afraid. They are afraid that, you know, criminals with AR-15s and AK-47s could very well come after sure. them if they talk with police. So I know when I was reporting this series, some people were afraid to even speak to me because they didn't want to give the appearance that they were talking to anyone about what happened.
There's concern. Clearly, if someone's involved already in illicit activity, they don't have an incentive to talk to legal authorities. There's a concern of retribution or revenge violence, and we've seen that devastate communities like Liberty City and other communities around South Florida. But is there what's also the forces behind not wanting to engage with law enforcement? Is that an issue in Liberty City and other places where we've seen this kind of community violence?
I think that's part of it, but it's not the only thing. I mean, I interviewed individuals who said it's not that we don't want to talk to the police. It's that when we do speak with the police, we want to know that we'll be safe. We want to know that, you know, we don't have to live among this killer's family members, this killer's siblings, this killer's fellow gang members when I come back home. One of the things that Commander Dana Card mentioned in the course of our interview was it would be helpful if there were more resources that were available to relocate witnesses when they cooperate with police and the state attorney's office, that they would be able to move them out of the neighborhood and into another neighborhood, because one of the main concerns of residents is that they have to return to the same neighborhood. And yeah. what if, you know, the charges, as we have seen, are dropped against this individual and he or she returns back to the same street across the street from where you live?
You spoke to a number of community members and you mentioned their reluctance perhaps to even talk to you. Would a witness relocation program, a domestic witness relocation program with this kind of community violence, not racketeering charges, not mob activity that we're so used to hearing about witness relocation, but community violence, would they be interested in that?
From what I'm hearing, yes.
Yeah.
And Commander Carr says that there's some program, and I'm not very familiar with it, with the state attorney's office that helps to some degree with that when there are cooperating witnesses. But she said the amount of resources, the amount of money that is dedicated to that is not enough to really help the way she would like to see it help in the neighborhood. And maybe that would be an incentive for people to help, you know, to cooperate with police.
Sure.
It's one of the many solutions that she and other city leaders have brought up in the course of my reporting this series.
We're speaking with WLRN's Nadege Green about her series Aftermath, Beyond the Bullets, from the June 24th mass shooting in Liberty City. You can see the online coverage at WLRN.org/aftermath. Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN or on the telephone 1-800-743-9576. Here on the Florida Roundup, the phone number 1-800-743-WLRN. Have you experienced community violence in your neighborhood? Have you left a neighborhood that was experiencing community violence? Let us know your story at 1-800-743-9576. And again, online at WLRN.org. /aftermath is where the coverage is. This week, Nadege, beyond South Florida here, we've seen how a community in the United States can react when police are involved in a shooting. Ferguson, Missouri, is all over the news this week, and rightfully so. Several nights of protests in Ferguson after an unarmed black teenager was shot and killed by a police officer last weekend. We also saw how the police response to the protesters may influence how the community responds. In your course of reporting this out in Liberty City, what was the community response to the police response? Did they get a sense that the police have supported the efforts within the community, that there is real interest in some of these troubles in the community?
Honestly, it's been a mixed bag. Hmm. I interviewed individuals who felt that the police have done all they can do, but the missing component is the community.
And what parts of the community are missing in their estimation?
Well, specifically, and let me just clarify, when we're talking about violence in Liberty City, it's not the entire neighborhood.
Sure.
This is specifically the area around the Liberty Square housing projects and a few streets surrounding it. So when I talked to those residents in that area for my series, some of them said they thought Miami police were doing a good job, just that they really couldn't beat the gang members. Many of these gang members grew up in the neighborhood. They know the neighborhood better than any police officer ever would. They have escape routes within inside the housing projects. They have designated houses that they run into after they commit the crime. And there's no way for police to get on top of that without the community cooperating with them, telling them what they know. But then there are also other residents who are frustrated with Miami police, and they don't think they're doing a good enough job. And some of them, like Commissioner Hardiman has asked for, are saying that, you know, Miami police, you've done all you could. It's not good enough. Let the feds come in and take over.
What's been the reaction to by that? It's not an official request that we know of, is it? Is there an official request to have the Department of Justice come in?
It's not an official request that we know of, but it is a suggestion that the
city
should.
And how's that been greeted by the city?
I don't think the entire commission agrees with Commissioner Hardiman. The mayor surely doesn't. He does not think that the issue of crime in Liberty City has risen to the level of needing federal intervention. The mayor, Mayor Tomas Regalado, does believe what Miami police needs to help solve these investigations is more cooperation from the community members.
You mentioned Commissioner Hardiman making this call, perhaps, or at least floating the idea of federal involvement in these areas of Liberty City. He thinks that there should be more public outrage over that violence.
Where Timmy and Tommy and Jane and Jacob get shot. But when Peanut, Tyrone, Tiro and anyone else gets shot in our communities, it's just, it is what happens in the black community. So, and that, to me, is unacceptable.
You know, when he makes that kind of comparison, clearly between a minority community and a white community, or a black community and a white community, how is that greeted within his own community?
They agree. The residents of Liberty City, during several of my interviews, people said if this was happening in Coral Gables, if this was happening, you know, in Brickell, it would not be happening for long. So they do feel that there is some racial tension or some racial issue and the response of what is happening. Commissioner Hardiman has called out the entire City of Miami Commission, saying that he doesn't feel that the crime problem in Liberty City is a citywide issue. He thinks that the commission thinks it's only his issue that's happening in Liberty City, but that it's not a Miami issue. And he says until that happens, he thinks his job will be a challenge, because, of course, in order to do anything on the commission, you're going to need more than one vote.
Sure. Nadege Green here from WLRN, covering Beyond the Bullets, the aftermath of the June 24th mass shooting in Liberty City. The coverage at WLRN.org. Nadege, we know our history here. This area in the city of Miami is no stranger to police tension, no stranger to racial tension. The McDuffie riots back in 1980 tore through the neighborhood for 3 days and nights, sparked after several police officers were acquitted by an all-white jury in Tampa when they were charged with beating a black man to death after a high-speed chase. And now you're hearing calls from city commissioners in the city of Miami. Commissioner Mark Sarnoff specifically wants to see how much money the city has spent in this neighborhood and perhaps what's the return on that investment. What do you think he's after there?
Commissioner Sarnoff is asking for an analysis, an internal analysis within the city of how much money has been invested, how much city money, taxpayer dollars have been invested in the Liberty City neighborhood dating back to the riots. And his point is to see, or he says his point is to see whether or not this money has been invested properly. Has it really made a difference in the neighborhood? I mean, he doesn't know what the hard number is. Perhaps he says it's not enough money that's been invested in the neighborhood, and that's why the situation is the way it is. But if millions of dollars have been poured into Liberty City in the past 2 decades and there's been no tangible results or no real results that show that the neighborhood is improving, he says perhaps the city should do something different or use the money differently than how it's been using it in the past. And so the idea is that this analysis will be a guide of sorts for the commission to see what has worked, what hasn't worked, and whether or not to change the way it's been doing things.
Nadege Green covering the aftermath of the June 24th Liberty City shootings here on the Florida Roundup. Fiona joins the program from Hollandale. Fiona, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. You basically just talked about it, Commissioner Sarnoff. And it may seem politically incorrect and maybe dangerous for him to kind of ask for the analysis that there's always an understanding that it's racist to look at other causes. I wonder your comment, I'm not sure if it was another commissioner, said, you know, if it were Peanuts and Tyrone, you know, it's a black problem. But in the other communities, do you not have people coming forward and saying they're the witnesses? And perhaps there needs to be some different leadership in the African-American community itself.
Fiona from Hallandale, thanks for the phone call and for the question. Nadej, you spoke with some of those community leaders as part of this series, and some of them spoke specifically about this no-snitch culture, as well as the insecurity that law-abiding citizens feel when talking to police because of possible backlash.
Right. But first, I want to get to her comment on Commissioner Hardiman's Peanut and Tyrone statement.
Yes.
Because what he was specifically referring to was national outrage, not local outrage. He was saying that when there are mass shootings happening in black communities, for example, it doesn't necessarily, you know, make the front page or, you know, the headlines. You know, the president isn't weighing in on this. And his concern was that, you know, this is gun violence, that this is AK-47s being used in a neighborhood, and that, you know, just as the nation is outraged when there are mass shootings in schools or in other neighborhoods, that same outrage should be expressed when it's, you know, the daily shootings happening in urban communities such as Liberty City and Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was making kind of a national comparison in terms of the community response. What about that local response from the community leaders, from Fiona's additional point about, you know, other kind of non-elected leaders within a community?
I think absolutely in Liberty City, not just Commissioner Hardiman has pointed to this, but the residents themselves have said that, you know, this isn't just an issue for outsiders to solve. This is not just an issue for government to solve or for the police to solve, but they're like, this is an issue that we as a community have to solve. So they point their fingers at their neighbors. You know, when you see someone selling drugs on the corner of the street, call 911. When you know that your child is, you know, living in your home and he has an AK-47 under his bed or in the closet, you should not have that happening, and you should call the police. And so part of the conversations I had with many of the residents, including the mom of one of the murdered victims of the shooting, Hermana Richardson, is that she's calling for the parents in the Liberty Square housing projects to out their own kids who are committing these crimes. She's calling for the friends of her son who were shot in that mass shooting who are not cooperating to police. Her exact words were, you need to open your mouth. So she's not really concerned with the politicians, and she's not concerned with the police. She says, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. She's holding accountable her own community, and she says, look, I'm one of you. I live here. My son lived here. He was friends with you guys, and you guys should seek justice for him because he is you.
You can see pictures of all this. You can hear audio sound bites of those involved and a map of the area, as well as all of our coverage at WLRN.org/aftermath, reported out by Nadej Green here on WLRN. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences with us, Nadej.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, still to come here on the Florida Roundup. A century ago, two continents cut in half and remembering two artists who brought Miami to the masses. Back to the program on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It was 100 years ago today when a French boat became the first self-propelled ocean-going vessel to transverse the continent by going through the Panama Canal. It signaled a new beginning in what was a $375 million project a century ago to slice through Central America, forming a 50-mile vein through which world trade has flowed ever since. Today, the canal is undergoing a $6 billion-plus expansion, and even as that nears completion, another larger expansion may be in the offing in the next several years. Panama Canal Authority Administrator Jorge Quiano acknowledged as much back in April when he spoke to WLRN.
When we put out the bid for the construction of the locks, one of the requirements was that you could build the other set of locks, whether it was the same or larger, right next to it, because we feel that within 15 years, we should be looking at the four set of locks of a much larger lock.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Jackie Charles covers the Caribbean for the Miami Herald, both joining me now on the Florida Roundup. Tim, what do we know about the status of this current expansion?
Well, it's going on, even though we had a two-week shutdown of construction earlier this year because of a dispute between the Canal Authority and a consortium of European firms that are building the major set of locks there over a kind of an alarming $1.6 billion cost overrun. And even though we've, you know, construction is ongoing now, it has continued, and we're hoping that it will be done either by the end of next year or early 2016, there's still a cloud hanging over this project because of that cost overrun dispute, some of which is now being going through international arbitration here in Miami.
Yeah, they finally agreed, to the panel of the
right.
judges who will hear this, essentially.
Yeah, but that always takes a little time
sure.
in international arbitration. But things are moving on now, so it'll be interesting to see how that's resolved.
What's the importance to South Florida when it comes to this Panama Canal expansion?
Oh,
we've seen the bigger cranes in Port Miami already.
It's very important, not just to Miami, but to a number of U.S. port cities that have made billion-dollar expansions of their own ports here as a way of capitalizing on what they call the post-Panamax ships that are going to be, you know, these larger vessels that are going to be coming through the Panama Canal as a result of this expansion. And in order to recoup the investment that they've made in these port expansions, they want to see that expansion of the Panama Canal done as soon as possible.
What about the Caribbean, Jackie? What's the importance of this expansion to the Caribbean nations?
Well, what's interesting is we have Jamaica and both Trinidad are trying to find ways to take advantage of this. We already have huge port infrastructure investment that took place in Freeport, the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. Chinese went in there a couple of years ago, and they're saying that they are prepared to handle these post-Panamax ships, and they see themselves in competition with Florida, the Bahamas, that is. But clearly, the Caribbean is looking at this and looking at ways that they can take advantage, get some funds, some money in there. And so we're watching to see, because right now, the ports in the region cannot handle these post-Panamax ships. They have to dredge.
Right. And what's important for a country like Trinidad, whose main export really these days is liquefied natural gas, products like that, it doesn't make any sense to ship them in anything except the largest
yeah.
vessels available. And that's why the Panama Canal is now considering an even larger expansion after this one.
You know, I remember speaking with the director of Port Everglades, which is the another significant port here in South Florida. We talk a lot about Port Miami with the new tunnel, but Port Everglades is huge. All the fuel
right.
that we burn in our cars and in our airplanes and even in our marine industry comes through Port Everglades. It's got a huge fuel transfer. They're digging deeper. They're getting prepared for post-Panamax. But the port director has said there, a lot of their trade is not necessarily east-west. It's north-south. It may not necessarily be impacted by more ships coming in as they come through the Caribbean. Instead, it's the east coast of South America that they're seeing activity there. What about to Panama, though, Tim? I mean, the Panamanians have for generations counted on the canal and the fees paid in the canal to help support the economy and the politics there.
Well, ever since the U.S. handed control of the canal over to the Panamanians 14 years ago, they have made a much better go of it than the Americans did. They've turned it into a much more profitable and efficient business. And what they want to do is they want to parlay that eventually in this century into making Panama the Hong Kong of the Americas, a major financial and maritime hub here, to rival Miami, as they're very quick to admit.
Meantime, moving from Panama Canal to Guantanamo Bay, it was 20 years ago this year when a wave of Cubans fleeing the island on rafts, bolseros, came to the U.S. land. Thousands of Haitians, Jackie, were already there. 15,000 had left their country amid violence and political unrest over the previous few years in the early 90s. The Guantanamo Public Memory Project collects these stories. It's touring South Florida. What is the memory like of Guantanamo for Haitians?
Well, it's a very interesting. It depends on which Haitians you're talking to. If you talk to people here in South Florida, they will tell you that 1994 was a watershed year for the Haitian American community here in South Florida. We had the children, the unaccompanied minors who were at Guantanamo. They were seen as being warehoused. It really launched the activism of the Haitian community. A lot of them stopped sort of viewing themselves as preparing to go back to Haiti, but then became Haitian Americans mm-hmm. and decided that they could influence the politics in Haiti from South Florida. But for people who lived, those years at Guantanamo, the memory is still there. Those were not very nice years.
What were the conditions like for the Haitians in Guantanamo Bay?
Well, the conditions were not very good. I mean, for children, when we take the children, there were reports of kids who were just really depressed. There were reports about rape. There were kids who were contemplating suicide. I mean, just to be in a situation of not knowing where you're going to go. The tent cities, they were dusty. You also had a situation where you had people who had already been approved for entry into the U.S., but either they or members of their family tested positive for HIV. You know, it's just a very difficult situation to know that you're fleeing the political violence of your homeland and you don't know where you're going.
You talk about the treatment of Haitians when it comes to immigration, and really this was a huge schism back 20 years ago, Tim, with what was going on in Guantanamo. The Haitians there and the Cuban Balseros, the Balseros were allowed to enter the U.S. in a lot of cases where many of the Haitians were not granted political asylum.
Right. Jackie and I were just talking before we came on about how one of the other watershed aspects of this whole episode was that the world, particularly the United States, began to realize that Haitian migrants weren't just economic refugees, but political refugees, and that they, as Jackie said, they began to see themselves as more of a diaspora community in much the same way that the Cuban exile community is, and that they deserved the same sort of immigration treatment that the Cubans were receiving.
Jackie, and here we are 20 years later dealing and debating another migrant children issue from a different area of the world, although not that far, obviously, from the Caribbean, from Central America, Nicaragua, Honduras, and places around there. What are the lessons learned 20 years ago from the Guantanamo treatment of Haitian migrants to today?
Well, I mean, one could debate what are the lessons learned, but I think definitely when you look at children, I mean, today you see with immigration advocates and even within our own system that there's a lot of concern about children, especially unaccompanied children, not to put them in harsh conditions. So we see kids are being put into foster care or other places. So I think that out of Guantanamo, there's been a lot of sensitivity about how do we treat immigrant children. But as far as an overall larger immigration issue, we're still debating immigration in this country. We're still debating whether Haitians or political or economic refugees. I mean, it took an earthquake for Haitians to get temporary protected status, which other communities have had for years.
Oh, and that's exactly the debate that's going on right now with the Central American refugees. Right. Are they economic or political? And there's really a gray area. It's not so much political refugees. They're refugees from this appalling gang violence that has gripped the Northern Triangle of Central America now for a decade.
I want to bring us back to the Guantanamo Public Memory Project here, Jackie. What are the memories of relations between Haiti and the U.S., and how have those changed in the 20 years since the Haitian refugees sought refuge in Guantanamo?
You know, it's interesting because you know, in 2008, when we had four hurricanes hit Haiti in 30 days, I started to see this change in terms of the U.S. I mean, Haitians in Haiti realized that their government was weak and they really needed to look to the U.S. to the outside. And we saw the impact of that after the earthquake.
Right.
But I have to tell you today, I'm not so sure how Haitians are feeling about the United States with everything that's going on in Haiti. You know, there's always this sort of tension there. But what we are seeing here in this community, I believe, is that your Haitians are increasingly seeing themselves as Haitian Americans or Americans and less Haitian, and they're more concerned about what's happening in their communities here and the issues that are affecting them. I think a lot of people are slowly giving up that dream of returning back to Haiti.
Jackie Charles covering the Caribbean, including Haiti, for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett covering the Caribbean and Latin America for us here on WLRN. Thanks to both of you for your thoughts. Finally, we remember two artists who made an impact on South Florida and brought Miami to the masses. First, Robin Williams. The actor and comedian's list of television and film credits is awfully long and very impressive, but it's the movie set at the Carlisle Hotel on Ocean Drive that still resonates today in South Florida. Here's Julia Duba.
You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do fussy, fussy, fussy. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham.
That's Robin Williams' character in The Birdcage. He's training a dancer to perform a show inside the Carlisle Hotel in South Beach. In the movie, Williams plays a gay man who owns a drag nightclub and is trying to disguise his partner as a tough straight man. It's all to fool his very conservative soon-to-be in-laws when they come over for dinner. Visitors stopping by the Carlisle for lunch may or may not have known Williams filmed The Birdcage there, but chances are they have a favorite Robin Williams movie.
Patch Adams.
What dreams may come.
Lover, Jumanji. And
I remember him as a very funny man.
He was such a big part of everyone's childhood.
Uses his quirky sense of humor.
He's just probably one of the funniest actors.
It'll be a memorable experience to eat lunch here today, of all days.
The movie was a step away from the 80s Miami Vice era depiction of Miami Beach and a nod to the nightlife scene the city is still known for today. There's a painted portrait of a wide-eyed Robin Williams looking out a window in front of the Carlyle. Among so many iconic roles, Robin Williams' performance in The Birdcage will always belong to South Florida. I'm Julia Duba in Miami.
Robin Williams died this week in his home north of San Francisco. While Williams brought movie fans to Miami Beach with Birdcage, Henry Stone brought Miami bass and disco to the music charts. Stone was a music producer, promoter, and publisher. He may be best known for his work with TK Records, which he founded in the 1960s and was home to many soul, rhythm and blues, and early disco records. Bill Kelly was around in those days as a club DJ in South Florida. Kelly went on to found the Winter Music Conference, the preeminent conference for dance music. It's still around today. We spoke with Kelly about how he remembers Henry Stone.
I remember going to TK Studios almost every week. I'd go to TK Studios to see what the latest releases were, and they would give me all the product, and I'd get a chance to listen to it. I'd come back the next week to give them feedback. You know, Henry used to say to me, listen, why don't you stick around and you're doing a studio session and, why don't you stick around and tell me what you think of it, you know. I remember sitting in a sax with one of the mixers, the name of sax, because he used to be a saxophone player, and he was one of the engineers. And I used to fall asleep on the couch behind him because, it was a tedious thing to listen to a track over and over and over again. But I used to do it because I had this love for... I never knew when I woke up who was going to be there. Sometimes it was Casey, sometimes it was Betty Wright. I mean, it was all these great artists that came through. And Henry was the catalyst for all that. He's definitely left a legacy, so there's no doubt about that. It's a business now, and although it's been a business with him for many years as well, he would sign something and hear something and immediately, just out of one song, immediately say, that's a hit, we have to put that on the record. There's a lot of firsts that Henry Stone did, and I don't think that in this day and age, I don't think there's going to be a lot of firsts like there were back when Henry Stone was around. So he was a pioneer for sure.
Longtime Miami DJ Bill Kelly there, remembering TK Records boss Henry Stone. Stone passed away this week in Miami at the age of 93. His music still brings lots of smiles and lots of hips shaking around South Florida and the world. That is it for this edition of the Florida Roundup here on Friday, August 15th. Thank you to all our guests and callers. If you missed the program, back on the air Saturday morning, 6 a.m., and online this afternoon at WLRN.org. The program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor for the program, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Thank you, sir. Well done behind the board. Stay tuned for Ed Bell. South Florida Arts Beat is next here from South Florida Film Critics. I'm Tom Hudson on the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening.